Welcome to the December podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Pincham. The December issue is on the topic of deformations and malformations, the history of induced and congenital skull deformity. In this podcast, topic editor Dr. Charles Prestigiacomo of the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, Newark, speaks with Dr. William Gump of the Neurosurgical Institute of Kentucky, Louisville. They discuss Dr. Gump's article, Modern Induced Skull Deformity in Adults, which appears in this month's issue.
Welcome to all to the Neurosurgical Focus podcast for our December issue discussing deformations and malformations of the skull, congenital and induced skull deformities. I'm Charles Prestigiacomo, co-editor of this December issue, and with me is Dr. William Gump from COSAIR Children's Hospital in Louisville, Kentucky. Good day to you, Dr. Gump.
Good afternoon, Dr. Prestigiacomo. Thanks for inviting me to talk with you today.
Thank you. As you know, this issue brought together a variety of different disciplines under one issue with a singular common theme. Of these, we editors felt that yours brought a unique and intriguing view of this issue's theme. Dr. Gump, you focused on modern-day skull deformations. What was the motivation to look into this topic for you?
Well, I think that a lot of other papers in this issue and in the broader literature really have looked a lot at the history of skull deformation in a lot of cultures, and this is something which seems to have emerged all over the world dating back for thousands of years. And I think that, as has been observed, that a lot of these practices are dying out and are certainly not as commonly pursued as they used to be. In this case, I felt like that there was this emergent technology or interest, if you will, in trying some things which had never really been explored before on adults, and I didn't really see much in the literature about new things in this area. So I thought it would be an interesting contribution to the neurosurgical literature.
That's actually a very good point, and you mentioned a number of times that these are practiced by a very small group, but the prevalence does seem to be increasing. Is that correct?
I think so. I think even just within living memory for most of us, I think that things just like body piercing have gone from being very rare, particularly outside of the earlobes, to something where it's not uncommon to see plenty of people walking around with pierced tongues and eyebrows and anywhere else on your body. And I think there's this tendency for individuals to want to try and push the envelope a little bit, and it's getting harder to come up with novel and new ways to explore what we can do.
It's very interesting you bring that up, because it seems as though it does work as a means of distinguishing individuals in a cultural society, whether in the past it was to show either a higher social status, or today to just show that people have an individuality about them beyond the quote-unquote groups of people or typical societal norms. It seems as though those are the statements that are being made, and that is transcends time throughout the cultures as well. You also mentioned that these procedures, the modern-day deformations, are predominantly dermal and subdermal, but there are some that are procedures that actually breach the outer table of the calvarium. Now, are there concerns about who is performing these procedures and where these procedures are being performed as far as location?
Well, I think obviously from our perspective, I think this would sound somewhat alarming at first, that non-medical professionals are doing things where you're implanting stuff into the bones. This is something that is obviously not very widely practiced at all. And in what I have read about the subject is that there are a very small number of practitioners who are really willing to perform procedures such as that. And among those, I think the individual that's the most active is a gentleman by the name of Stephen Hayworth, who himself came from a family where they were in the business of designing and selling medical instrumentation. Stephen Hayworth himself initially got started in body piercing, and really was sort of considered one of the more visionary, kind of exploratory sort of practitioner of this. And I think it's just sort of a natural extension of him looking for, you know, how much further can we take this, that combined with his just experience with medical instrumentation, that he started to to look at implanting things in the skull. And as he was doing this, I mean, obviously there was some interest among people, out there who said, "Hey, I want to try something else, novel out." And when everybody comes together, then you can end up with results like the gentleman who has the so-called metal mohawk.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
And a few other, so far as I'm aware, I mean, there's a really limited number of people who have, undergone procedures like this. But again, I think it's interesting that we really haven't encountered, so far as I'm aware, medically, any significant problems that have emerged thus far.
Now, could it be that the complications, or potentially you had mentioned them as misadventures at some point, could it be that these complications, if they are occurring, are being taken care of at a very local level and therefore are not making the published literature or the media? For instance, body piercings that may become secondarily infected and so forth and so on are usually treated at a very local level. Is this something that you think may be happening with this, and as the procedures get a little bit more invasive, we might end up seeing them come to our front door?
I think that's a possibility. I mean, certainly any time you undergo any sort of piercing, there is a risk of an infection associated with that. It's not something which requires a high level of medical sophistication to treat. As the procedures themselves get more complicated, I think that the treatment for possible complications obviously is going to get more complicated. I think that one thing which is telling, particularly with Stephen Hayworth, is that it seems like, especially from his blog on the internet, is that he actually is cognizant of the potential for problems to arise and seems to keep track of, okay, look, I put in the subdermal implant, and he, I think, mentions at one point there was one that didn't really take and ended up getting, being coming out. And I don't think this is in the head. I mean, this is something in somebody's shoulder, I think. Mm-hmm. And so there is an awareness, I think, in the part of, the people who are doing these things that this is not something which is risk-free or completely benign.
Is there any discussion or any possibility that these individuals are looking towards either the neurosurgeon, or in the case of just the subdermal, transdermal implants, maybe plastic surgeons or cosmetic surgeons, to be present or to be involved in the more complex of issues?
To my knowledge, that hasn't been the case for neurosurgery particularly. I mean, I think that in regard to plastic surgeons, I mean, that there are procedures which are well accepted right now that involving implants in order to enhance what we would consider to be normal anatomy, and so certainly I think that it would not be a stretch to believe that a plastic surgeon would potentially be available for something more along the lines of what we're talking about here with subdermal implants in the scalp. To my knowledge, that hasn't really been part of the picture so far, and maybe as these things get a little bit more exotic and become larger and more sophisticated, that'll ultimately be the case.
That's correct. And you've mentioned about enhancing normal anatomy in unique and striking ways. You then bring your article to sort of a different aspect, which is the trephining. It's, in a way, you're correct in considering it a form of deformation, but the desired results of trephining really aren't the cosmetic issues, as they are more, as you discuss, sort of the proposed physiologic benefits of trephining. What are some of the concerns about trephining as a practice amongst the lay public?
I think that now, unlike the deformation things that we've talked about so far, there is at least one documented case of a medical complication coming from this procedure. Now, the trephination, as you mentioned, is not something which is done really for cosmetic purposes. I think the practitioners of this may, some at least, would argue that, well, there is some historical context for this, and that this has been done. I mean, as we know, that there are skulls that have been discovered in lots of different ancient civilizations with holes in them, and the purpose of those holes has been obviously the subject of some controversy, and it's not the standard anthropological understanding that those holes were placed for mystic purposes for the most part. But the goal of this is to, as is described, to achieve an elevated level of consciousness. What has been encountered in at least one case about 15, 20 years ago now was a gentleman in England who took a power drill to his own head and subsequently developed a CSF leak, for which he just kind of sought help in the local emergency department. Unfortunately, this is not something which turned out to be lethal or with any significant long-term sequelae for him, but it did require a surgery in order to debride his wound, and he required antibiotics. And in that particular case, I mean, he also underwent kind of some psychiatric evaluation. But just given that the technique itself is usually described as something which is done by the person themselves, or maybe with the assistant of someone who is not a medical person, just taking essentially a home power tool to your own skull, I think that the potential for injury either to the venous sinuses or to the underlying brain is pretty high.
So you mentioned that you suggest that it actually mostly is done in the midline.
It is in the way that this was first done back in the 1960s and subsequent to that seems to be in the midline. What's interesting to me is that these often are not done behind the hairline. I think that from a neurosurgical perspective, we tend to try and imagine these things as being done in a more cosmetically neutral location, located somewhere that's hidden by the hair or something else, but in these cases, it's essentially just in the middle of the forehead, and I don't know from what I have read thus far if there's a specific reason for placing the trephination, in the midline or if it could be somewhere else.
You sort of bring us around full circle, because historically, as you know, physicians in various cultures have had not only an influence but also participated in the trepanation practices that you're just describing, as well as some of the skull deformation practices that occurred in other cultures. Is this something that we as a group or we as individuals should be involved? And if so, what should our involvement be, understanding that involvement in some instances might represent condoning, accepting, and perhaps encouraging this kind of practice?
Indeed. Well, with respect to cosmetic procedures, I think that culturally we have already kind of arrived at the point where it is acceptable and within the bounds of what we would consider to be a reasonable medical practice to pursue cosmetic surgery procedures. So as far as skull implants go, I don't think that it's a significant stretch to imagine that a neurosurgeon could reasonably be involved in those procedures, if they had an interest in doing so.
Mm-hmm.
And with regard to the trepanation for altering the level of consciousness, the issue there has fundamentally been that we don't really, this is done for indications that we can't really address strictly from a medical scientific standpoint, and indeed there have been some, I think as I mentioned in my paper, there was one instance where the trephanation was performed and the people doing the drilling themselves were arrested and charged with practicing medicine without a license.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be very difficult to make a case within the neurosurgical community that we should try drilling a burr hole somewhere on somebody's head in order to potentially provide what's described as an elevated level of consciousness or for more specifically for treatments like fibromyalgia or depression, which some people seem to be advocating outside of the formal medical community.
Yes, I see. Well, Dr. Gump, I thank you so much for your very insightful manuscript that was accepted for this month's issue of Neurosurgical Focus. As I said, it really sort of brings everything together with the theme of the issue. I also thank you very much for your time and your input for this podcast. I welcome everyone listening to this podcast to please refer to Dr. Gump's manuscript and the other manuscripts of this issue. I'm sure it will make quite fascinating reading and an incredible learning experience for all. Once again, thank you for your time, Dr. Gump.
Thank you very much.
This concludes our podcast for the December issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Thank you for listening. Please join us for the January issue, when the topic will be primitive neuroectodermal tumor. For more information on how to submit your research to Neurosurgical Focus or to see a list of upcoming topics, please visit thejns.org and click on Neurosurgical Focus. Comments on this podcast can be sent to jnspodcast@thejns.org.